other rights. For example, a person was said to surrender the right to a minimal amount of alienable property, collected as taxes, which the government required for its expenses. Now, this supposed agreement between the people and government never actually happened, and most social contract philosophers knew it. They did not believe in a real agreement located somewhere in the past, or more precisely, they did not believe in the historical reality of an explicit agreement based on the explicit consent of every person. To get their social contract off the ground, these philosophers appealed to what they called implied or tacit consent. This is the kind of agreement you give to pay your bill at a restaurant, for example, without stating beforehand your agreement to pay the bill. Your consent is seen as implicit in your actions. This raises a serious problem. If a social contract is implied by our actions, if the exact terms of the social contract are unstated and uncertain, then how can we know if a government violates its part of the agreement? Even an oppressive government can fall back on the social contract. Even an oppressive government can say its actions do not violate rights because the rights in question were surrendered as part of the social contract. This uncertainty creates a sticky problem for the social contract argument. The social contract, it seems, instead of justifying revolution, will always condemn it. This is inevitable if no limit is set on the rights supposedly surrendered or transferred to government in the unwritten and undefined social contract. The social contract advocates replied with an appeal to inalienable rights. These rights are impossible to surrender or transfer. Clearly, then, the previous excuse used by governments will never work with